Bon, merci pour l'invitation, merci pour être là. Je fais les remerciements en français, après je vais changer en anglais probablement. Peut-être que je fais un peu aller-retour entre les deux quand j'oublie. Photosystème 2, c'est l'enzyme de base photochimique et c'est peut-être le plus compliqué, j'ai l'impression. Et je pense à la fin de mon exposé, tous vont avoir la même impression. Mais on va voir si je peux clarifier certaines choses. Maintenant, voilà. In the beginning, if I can get this to work, is that correct? No. Yes. In the beginning, there was no oxygen. And it was photosynthesis that put the oxygen there. And it was when photosystem 2 evolved that it put the oxygen in the atmosphere. When it put it into the atmosphere, there was so much oxygen around that it allowed bioenergetics, the conversion of energy in life, to be so much more efficient than things could get complicated. So when the oxygen got to a sufficient level, then we could have respiration. Respiration is very efficient at moving energy around, and so life went from being unicellular to multicellular. What was actually going on was this photosynthesis. This is what's going on then, after that, because respiration was around. Photosynthesis was putting the energy into the biosphere in the form of reduced carbon. I've written it here as sugar, but reduced carbon and all the building blocks of life, and putting oxygen into the atmosphere and taking CO2 and combining it with water to make these products. Respiration is the reverse of that process, and it is while photosynthesis was putting the energy into the biosphere photon by photon, then respiration takes it out again and in useful biological sized chunks, which is ATP in a sense, which is being generated by respiration so that life can then work. That went on beautifully for a long time, but it was a cycle during a long period. It was a cycle that was very asymmetric in that the biomass accumulated and was not used up by respiration. Instead, it was laid down in the oceans and in the peat bogs. And in the peat bogs, it became coal, and in the oceans, it became petrol. But also, there was the brown stones, the shales, the tar sands, and all the rest of it that's gone into the earth. And while it did that, working asymmetrically, it pulled out the carbon dioxide that was in a high concentration in the atmosphere and stuffed it into the ground. Now, clever humans found it about 150 years ago and decided, in the blink of a geological eye, to stuff it back into the atmosphere. And it's the biggest problem that we have now on this planet. And I will say that although photosynthesis made changed the planet, made life work the way, put the fuels into the ground and all the rest of it, photosynthesis is not going to save us from this problem that we have, because I personally believe that biofuels are far too inefficient because photosynthesis is far too inefficient. So don't put your bets in that department there. If you do that, you will only accelerate the loss of species, the loss of forests, and the destruction of this planet. I hope I was clear. Water is very stable. Oxygen is as relatively unstable. In fact, it's much more stable than you'd expect because of all the energy that it's got in it. And that stability comes from the fact that it's a triplet state and it needs to change spins to react. So if the oxygen was not a triplet state, then the atmosphere would spontaneously combust. But nevertheless, it's got a lot of energy in it. And that energy is available for respiration. So it's very hard to oxidize water, and it's very favorable to reduce oxygen, which is this is why the energy is taken out in respiration and put in by photosynthesis. The solar energy is taken in to do this process. This is the reaction that occurs in photosystem 2. Here's photosystem 2 itself. This is a little cartoon that I tend to draw in the system. This is terminology. We call it photosystem 2 in lots of various different abbreviations, which I don't like. What it actually is a water plastoquinone photooxidoreductase. That tells you what it does. This tells you what it does as well in a chemical way. Two molecules of water are oxidized, two molecules of plastoquinone are reduced, and oxygen is released. What photosystem 2 is trying to do is to get electrons, that is to say, to reduce plastoquinone. But if you look at the thermodynamics of what's going on here, most of the light energy has actually gone into the formation of the oxygen. So what photosystem 2 is doing by accident, it's getting the electrons which it needs and it's going to use to fix CO2 later in photosynthesis, but it is, as a side effect, charging up the atmosphere with energy. And that's mainly what it's doing. Photosystem 1 is doing the big reducing question, but the photosystem 2 is producing oxygen by accident, and that's where most of the energy is going. What this rest of this picture says is that this enzyme here is in a membrane, and electron transfer takes place across the membrane. You've got the water splitting photosystem 2 part on the inside, you've got the quinone reduction on the outside, and you've got the photochemical part in the middle. We can go a little bit further in terms of the thermodynamics, and we can divide the big equation into two parts, two half reactions, the one I was talking about before, which is hard to do. It requires a lot of energy to do that. The midpoint potential, or the reduction potential, is about 820 millivolts. Under functional conditions, it's harder to do that because it's at pH 6, and this is how much energy is required to do that. This is rather an oxidizing process. It's very difficult to pull the electrons out of water. The quinone reduction is rather easy to do. It's not a very reducing reaction. To take the electrons from water and put them onto the plastoquinone is what the whole enzyme is doing. And if we look at the energy difference between these two values, that's in this it's about 700 millielectron volts, that should be. And then if we do that under functional conditions, it's even bigger than that. If you add the fact that the electrons are crossing the membrane, you get nearly another 200 millielectron volts are required for pushing against that. And overall, about one electron volt is stored or is required to actually get this. That's what you get in your chemistry after you've turned over photosystem two. And the energy that's required is the photon, the red photon, which has got the energy of 1.82 electron volts. So we get well over half. If that worked efficiently, we'd be getting well over half of the energy of the photon required in that. Right, so this is the green stuff. Many of you have seen this slide before. I can't help showing it. I did it when I first moved to France and I got invited to give a talk at the Rotary Club of Dompierre. And I thought I should give them something they'll understand. So I got as far as drawing this and then everything went to hell. But anyway, here's a leaf, and in the green stuff in the leaf is in the cells, and in the cells it's in the chloroplast, and in the chloroplast it's in the membranes, and in the membranes it's in the proteins. And there are two kinds of proteins that carry the green stuff. Those that do light collection and those that do the conversion of the energy of light into chemistry, the reaction centers. And so reaction centers I've spent most of my life working on, but I'm interested in the antenna these days, which is funny. I never thought I would. The green stuff in these systems is the big aromatic molecule with the magnesium in the middle, which is chlorophyll. Here's how chlorophyll works. If you keep going down, this is the last orbital, occupied orbital in a chlorophyll, and the first unoccupied molecular orbital corresponds to the energy difference of red light. So red light, when it's absorbed, kicks an electron up to the first excited state, and it will be up there, and this is the special thing about chlorophyll, for ages, that is to say about 5 nanoseconds. This is very long for this kind of system, so you can do something useful in that time. If you don't do anything useful with it, it'll come back as either as heat, go back down again, or as fluorescence. It's also got another excited state further up, which can correspond to the absorption of blue light. If it goes up to the blue light level, it instantly comes down, instantly femtoseconds down to the first excited state where it was, where it went up to if it was excited by red light. So the energy difference is lost. It absorbs in the blue, it absorbs in the red, it does not absorb in the green. The green comes through or bounces back and hits you in the eye and you say, ooh, that's a green molecule. So if you look at this green molecule and it's in its excited state, we don't want to lose that energy if it hangs around for longer than 5 nanoseconds. We want to do something useful with it. In the light collecting proteins, it is lined up with a whole bunch of other chlorophylls close by, almost the same color. And what happens is there is an excitation transfer process that occurs, so the excitation energy jumps onto the chlorophyll next door to it, and there's a whole manifold of those chlorophylls around, and in the 5 nanoseconds, they share. So basically what's going on in an antenna protein, you just need to get your molecules close enough together, all the same color, and it will share. So it harvests. One photon comes in, hits a surface of 200 molecules of chlorophyll in a manifold, and it will bounce around between those in the 5 nanoseconds, and then it will lose it again as heat or as fluorescence. You don't want to do that. How do you do something useful? Well, you make sure that you've got different kinds of proteins that have got the chlorophylls organized in such a way, chlorophyll-like molecules, close enough so that instead of doing excitation energy transfer, they do electron transfer. So that's what's going on here is there's a difference in redox and there's a difference in how these things are coupling. And so what happens is you get this fundamental thing occurring at the heart of the photosynthetic reaction center in that electron transfer takes place, forming a cation radical and an anion radical. This is very oxidizing, it wants an electron. This is very reducing, it wants to give away an electron. Why don't they go back together again? Well, that's what the photosystem is being built to avoid. It just keeps on pushing them further apart. So here's back to a picture, views of photosystem two. This is the one I'm going to talk about. I usually draw this. I call this the cuddling beans structure. The cuddling beans structure is because this, when you look at it, you can see it's symmetrical. It's symmetrical because it's evolved from a homodimer. This is a heterodimer. These two proteins, D1, D2, diffuse proteins, are actually almost purely symmetrical to each other. They have changed over time. It is a pseudo-heterodimer, and it's specialized so that the charge separation takes place on one side, the water splitting takes place on one side, not on that side, and the storing of how the quinone reduction works, because it's a complex two-electron process, is specialized in this bit as well. But it started off as a homodimer where it was the same on both sides. That's clear that that's the case when you think of its evolution. But another way you can look at these is to look at them in this way. This is what I call the hexagonal view. So it turns out that photosystem two looks exactly like France. I won't go into the fact that it's very weird that the iron is where the Eiffel Tower is and all, and you can teach this to a French audience in terms of main roads and cities, but I won't get into that, and possibly things coming in from Germany, but I don't want to get into that. And this side of things, we've got, this is another view now which you get much more commonly, which is the excess spaghetti view. That is to say, we know how these proteins are now. So you can put up pictures where you can see nothing but pretty colors. And you could even put in all of them, dozens of cofactors in here to confuse people even more. So I don't think that's a lot of use either. We'll go back to the cuddling beans. We go back to the cuddling beans because despite the fact that in the spaghetti, it's this one, D1 and D2 are wrapped up in this bit in the middle here, then all the important things are there anyway. So we don't need to look at the rest of that complexity. When we look at this, I've talked about water splitting this side, quinone reduction that side, two different kinds of enzymology and photochemistry in the middle. You've got essentially 6 chlorophylls in the middle, these two on the outside, and these are doing light harvesting in the main, and a bit of photochemistry, but not, but in a bit of chemistry, but not much. The ones in the middle, the four in the middle, form a cluster with the pheophytins. Pheophytins are the free base of chlorophylls. That is to say, the magnesium's gone and been replaced by two protons. And this makes this a good electron acceptor. It's lowered the potential. So that when you excite this system, the pheophytins pick up the electron. How does it work? Here's how it works. So we put this on a free energy scale, a standard free energy scale, and we'll look at the cuddling beans down here. And P680 is a generalized name, an old pigment name, saying that bleach occurred at 680 nanometers. And that's all it means. And these are all absorbing close to 680 nanometers. So there's no big deal here. It's not very specific in terms of a name, which is why we change things to be more specific. And this is a photon. It could be a red photon or a blue photon. It excites the system up to the first excited singlet state. And we could say, for the sake of argument, it's got 1.82 electron volts. And then charge separation takes place. The charge separation takes place between this one, which is called chlorophyll D1, and the pheophytin. But I've drawn it in this way so to avoid fights, but also because the first thing that you can properly resolve is a radical pair where the cation is on this chlorophyll here, which is called PD1, and the electron is on the pheophytin. So this one is actually two separate electron transfers, and one from this chlorophyll to there, and then an electron from this one to there. But the first thing you can see is this radical pair here, which is the PD1 on there and the pheophytin. That occurs in picoseconds. And then there's a stabilization when the electron goes from the pheophytin to the quinone to stabilize the charge pair. That's why it doesn't come back, one of the reasons it doesn't come back. And then the cation, which is formed on here, is oxidizing enough to rip an electron out of a tyrosyl, out of a tyrosine, which is close by, tyrosine Z. It doesn't throw its proton away. The proton stays very close and hydrogen bonded on a base. We'll see in a minute. And then the tyrosine is oxidizing enough to oxidize this manganese cluster down the bottom here. And then electron transfer takes place across the parallel to the membrane between the two quinones to stabilize, to form the last state. This state here we call this to QB minus, and this state is formed in about more than 90% on a flash, and it is formed in a millisecond, and it's going to be now stable for 30 seconds. And so we've done good chemistry here. Here's a more accurate value of the time. We've measured a lot of things since I drew that first picture. This is a more accurate view. The energy gap dropping down from pheophytin to QA is not as big as I drew it in the previous ones. We know what that is now. It's more like 350, 370 milli electron volts. But it's still a big stabilization step. Notice that the big drop downs are electron transfer on the electron donor side. We're losing reducing power, but we're not losing oxidizing power. That's really important because this is an enzyme that wants to oxidize. It doesn't care about the reduction because it's easy to reduce quinone. So we can throw that energy away to make it work in the right direction. And what's going on here is this is the amount of energy that's thrown away to get this to work in this direction. And I can draw another version of that. Since it's doing two electrons on that side, four electrons on this side, what this means is that actually you get intermediates that recombine. But once you average out all the electron transfer steps, there's four of these, they're all slightly different. You average them out, then the amount of energy that's gone into the chemistry is this much. And the amount of energy which is thrown away is this much out of the 1.82 electron volts. And this is really quite important. That thrown away is not a waste. That thrown away is to get things to work. If it was exactly the amount of energy you needed to have things stored away, nothing would go in that direction. You need some push in the system. This is what we call overpotential driving force to get the system to work. So this is the heat that's done that, is to achieve the high quantum yield of charge separation to give you the driving forces and to avoid back reactions, because back reactions actually kill this system. And I give another very long talk on that subject, which I'll avoid. And for this talk, what's important is that some of that heat is required to get water oxidation to work and to release the product, to release the oxygen from that. and we know all the other things. I mean, we've measured now the energies for releasing the quinol and stuff in this system. Just go back, have I got anything? Yeah, just so this is a take-home message. Photosystem is two is squeezed. These processes are compromised. If you had more energy, it would be more efficient. You would get more, you would get less damage, and you would get a higher quantum yield. But this system is stuck. It's working maximum for the energy that's available. It's not perfect. This, unlike all the other photosystems, it's working at about close to 90%, perhaps 88% quantum yield. The other ones work at 100%. This one can't do it because its job is too difficult. It has to split water. It's got a lot of energy requirements to do this, and it's inefficient. And as a result of that, it picks up all this damage and stuff. And that's one of the reasons why everything out there on the planet is actually working at the same place. It can't go to longer wavelengths to pick up the massive amount of infrared, near-infrared photons that are there to drive the system. It doesn't work very well. I'm working on that. There are two very obscure versions of Photosystem 2 that work in the infrared, and they have problems. That's why it hasn't taken over the planet. It would be too easy. This is another take-home message. There is no such thing as a free lunch. Okay, that's a different lecture as well. So how does Photosystem 2 do one electron chemistry and get it to interface with multi-electron chemistry? What it does is, and we've, I mean, again, I work on the quinone side, but we're not going to talk about that. We're going to talk about the donor side here for your benefit. This is the S-date cycle stuff. And this takes us straight back to Pierre Joliot. So Pierre Joliot was the first person to develop methodologies and make the measurements of water splitting in a flash by flash. He had a system, and if you know Pierre Joliot, then he always uses he uses living systems. I think that's because he's a rubbish biochemist. But I think that it's also because he's really very interested in living things, and he wants to study those kind of things. And one of the things that he developed was a special instrument which was able to measure oxygen evolution very rapidly. And if you give it a flash that was bright enough to hit all of your Photosystem 2s in your living sample, an algal sample, and excite them in one shot, and then turn it over and then hit them all and only hit them all once, then you can get this kind of synchronization which Mark was talking about at the end of his talk. Special thing about photoenzymes is if you let them dark adapt, they can get to a synchronized state, and then you can turn over the enzyme flash by flash. That's why we work on this stuff. It's the most fun enzymology that there is. And Pierre Joliot was the person to demonstrate this in Photosystem 2. Got this amazing observation that on the first flash there was no oxygen evolution, on the second one there was no oxygen evolution, on the third one there was a big amount of oxygen evolution, and then it took four more flashes before the peak came round, four more flashes before it came round. This is four electron chemistry, that's not a coincidence. A model was then developed by Bessel Koch, which we call the Koch cycle or the S-state cycle, and this is the fact that you get this strange three electron stuff, the third flash effect. That's because the stable state in the dark is mainly this one. This one where one charge is already stored. And we know the reasons for that now. But basically, it's starting in the S1 state, then going around in a cycle like this, and oxygen is being evolved when the S4 state, which is spontaneously generated, is formed. And people, this is just a drawing where we know now the protons don't come out all at the end and stuff. Okay, so how does water oxidation work? Let's get into that. We've got lots of questions. Here are some of them. You can look at them yourself. I don't need to talk about them. But we need to the whens, the wheres, the whys, the hows. That's what we're after. We're going to look closely at the redox cycle for water oxidation now. I've drawn it in this weird way with two S0s, and that is because I think it really does exist as two S0s. That is to say, there is an S0 with oxygen bound, hasn't been resolved, because the oxygen comes up very fast, but there's going to be an S0 with oxygen bound, and it's released during that time. But this is the standard cycle. These are the electrons coming out. What's this about? I mean, this is just to say there's been a huge amount of work done. Everything in the book has been thrown at this enzyme to try and figure out what's going on in the Koch cycle. What are these things? And what we did a lot of was EPR. EPR was the dominant method for about 20 years. I mean, from 1980 to about 2000, it was the dominant. It went out slightly when crystallography came in, but now it's back. It had to come back when the crystallography got good enough to be able to test mechanisms, because you need a way of testing things. Lots of these other things have provided huge amounts of information on this as well. So the role of manganese, if you can say, people knew that this corresponded to manganese, because in the old days, if you didn't give it manganese, then it didn't make water splitting. You fed it manganese, it worked. You hit the system, the manganese fell out. You knew the manganese was in there. But in 1980, it was discovered using EPR that the S2 state was a multivalence manganese, high valence manganese system. So that meant really we knew it was involved in this process. And this is just why manganese? Why manganese? Well, there's a lot of it around. There are many redox transitions. The potentials of manganese when it goes from like 3 to 4, and also actually from 2 to 3, the potentials can be in the order of about a volt. And that's the kind of thing we're looking for these kind of things. There are many different redox states in it. Manganese 2 is mobile and weakly bound and redox inactive. It goes to higher valence, and when it goes to higher valence, it spontaneously picks up waters. These are waters without the protons, oxo groups, but we could have them with the protons. And that means when you go up and down in redox states, you can spit out protons and compensate the charges. This is really all good stuff for manganese. It can go to manganese 5. It doesn't. I don't think it does in the enzyme, but it can go to manganese 5. It goes to more like this kind of thing in our enzyme. So there was all good reasons for why a manganese is there. So let's look at what's going on here as we go through the estate cycle. We know now that in the lowest potential form, we got 3 manganese 3s and a manganese 4. And then when we go up, we pull an electron out, spit out a proton, and we oxidize another manganese up to 2 manganese 4s. Then we get to S2, we've got 3 manganese 4s and manganese 3. When we get to S3, we have 4 manganese 4s. Strangely, when we get to S4, well, it's complicated. Not that strange, but certainly it's complicated. What has been observed, and this is really crucial, and it's a big problem for studying this enzyme, is that the manganese 4 with the tyrosine radical is got exactly the same lifetime as the release of the oxygen. So the electron transfer takes place as oxygen is released. That is to say, kinetically, all the interesting and complicated stuff that's going on after you've excited the S3 state is all hidden in there, because the rates of reaction are too slow to allow you to detect intermediates. And that's been known for a very long time. Okay, but it gets pulled apart a little bit, because we do know there are lag phases. This lag phase was discovered by Fabrice Rappaport, and it was then followed up by Holger Dow. And the guys, there's a lag phase in after the formation of the tyrosine in the S3, in the presence of the S3 state. But still, there has been no other intermediates detected as you go through the complicated chemistry of ripping the water apart and spitting out the oxygen. So that was what happened there when we got to that, when we got to S3. It actually all happens in one shot and in a black box, because we don't know what's happening, essentially. That's what that was about. So here's some features of the enzyme. The most oxidized state, 2 molecules of water are oxidized in a four electron process with no detectable intermediates so far. The other oxidation steps are all the enzyme going oxidized. Manganese goes oxidized until the manganese and the tyrosine goes oxidized together, and the next thing you see is the oxygen comes out. The charge accumulation steps are compensated by proton release mainly. Nearly everyone's compensated by that. That's a big deal. I've drew the protons on there. It's really quite important. If you didn't compensate the charge, then the potential would be different on every step, and it would just be hugely wasteful and wouldn't work. Substrate waters are exchangeable in all states except in the tyrosine Z.S3 state, and this was demonstrated by Alain Boussac's amazing experiment where he exchanged the calcium, which you'll see later, exchanged the calcium and the chloride for strontium and iodide, and slowed down that last step from 1 millisecond to about 40 milliseconds or more. And so you can work on it and you can see that there is no water exchange during any of that time. There's water exchange in all of the other estates. Completely amazing experiment. We did it with, took those samples to a messenger who did the mass spec on that to demonstrate that. So here's the story. So four electrons in one shot, that means you've avoided all these nasty intermediates that are in between. If you look, if you're trying to oxidize water by one electron, then you can't do it with any of the oxidizing powers that exist in biology. You simply can't do it. You might be able to do a two-electron thing, but that's pretty far, and that's actually still too much for the kind of oxidation powers that we have in photosystem two. So basically, you've got to do this by storing up four and then doing it on average in one shot, if you can, as close to one shot as possible. You've got all the midpoint potentials and everything, I won't go through it. This is the idea. So instead of trying to climb up these mountains, and then there's some downhill stuff as you go from superoxide to oxygen, you try and do it as equal as possible. If you were designing this yourself, you would make all these steps equal. That would be the most efficient thing you could do, biggest driving force with, because you're using the same oxidant on every step. It's P plus that's the oxidant on every step. This is how you do it. In actual fact, it turns out this is a smaller step, and there's some other variations in the steps. But effectively, you can think of it being something like that. Why is this a smaller step? We don't know. I think it might be a redox lock thing to prevent the manganese going back down to manganese 2. And that's really important because it's for efficiency of the system. So that's really what's going on there. You manage to get it to work in this way. But we can also say that this is only possible by getting rid of the protons and compensating the charges, because if you really accumulated the charges, then it would just stop, because you'd run out of, because you'd be trying to put charges next to other charges. You've got to compensate, otherwise it won't work. Okay, then this is what I was telling you about. This is the rate-limiting step problem I was telling you before. I don't need to go through that again. So we got some of what's going on. Here's some of the questions that are being solved. When does water get oxidized? Right at the end, we know that. When is manganese oxidized? All the way through, up to manganese 4. What's the valence of the manganese? We know that. I showed you that. Is the amino acid radical chemistry not directly involved in water oxidation? But it is playing an important role, we'll see in a minute. And then when does the substrate water bind? Well, we saw that stuff because of the Boussac experiment I was telling you about. Things are exchangeable all the way through, so it's binding and stuff like that, but it stops being exchangeable on that last step. But there's more information on that in a minute. So let's look at some more questions. So how does the water get oxidized, and what's the structure of the active site? So let's look at the manganese question. So history of this, just look at my timing. History of this is that there was some major spectroscopic methods that played big roles. And I've got no time at all really to deal with this kind of stuff, except to say X-ray absorption was important. Here's the things you could do with X-ray absorption that came out of that kind of stuff that are quite interesting. Stuff about oxo-hydroxyl bridges on the N0S1 site, but Holger Dow did that. There's different stuff in terms of what's going on. Again, the samples that were provided by Alan Boussac to the Berkeley group, where he's replaced with strontium, showed that there was some structural changes around the calcium when you go from the S2 to S3 state. We already knew that from EPR, but they were able to demonstrate that by EXAS. This was important in terms of the X-ray absorption edge data, which tells you about how redox things were going on. But this was ambiguous as well, whether S2 to S3 was actually oxidation or not. So certainly it was clear that S3 to S0 was manganese reduction. Again, go back round in the cycle. EPR did lots of stuff, and of course we were involved in this in big ways. There's so much that I can't really cover, but the point is that it turned out that S0, S1, S2, S3, and all the states, basically S4, which is tyrosine, which is S3 tyrosine Z dot, you could detect by EPR. You spin half states for S0 and S2, and there are the spin isomers in S2, the spin isomers in S3 as well, which is quite interesting. And a lot of this was done by Alan Boussac. Lots and lots of groups were working on this, but in terms of longevity of what observations were correct, the majority, I would say, and I'm biased, but the majority are the ones that came from out of Saclay. And that is because it was cleaner stuff. We had better spectra and we had better control over the biochemistry than all the other groups. I don't think there's any doubt about that. So spin isomers for S2 and S3, S2 to S3 sensitive to light. This was a discovery of Alan Busack and me working together on that. Amazing times where I'm like, how could this possibly happen when I'm illuminating this system and we know it can't happen? Well, maybe it's photochemistry of the manganese. And I went away, came back an hour later, discovery of photochemistry of the manganese itself. Spin state changes demonstrated at low temperatures. These are massively well known in iron chemistry, but were discovered for the first time in this enzyme. Coupling scheme indicates that the S2 signals that the manganese are strongly coupled with, three of them are strongly coupled and one of them less so. This is a Dave Britt thing. And that was really important because actually that gave some structural idea that it was a 3+1 type structure, and that certainly is, and that was well before. Here's some of the EPR stuff that's going on. This was discovered in 1980 by Dismukes and Sidra. I discovered the G equals 4, and it was published at the same time by us and by the Berkeley group. This is the high spin state, and it's spin 5 half of just G4, as Alain demonstrated by doing spin stuff, spin methods to determine what was going on there. Other groups worked on this a lot as well. And as I said, Brit's group came out with the relationship between these. We'll come out to that. We did things like give flash sequence, follow the Joliot experiment, but doing it with EPR, showing that these things oscillate with periods of 4. That's what you had to do. This is the Dave Britt observation that you could get the low spin and the high spin form from this 3+1 type structure in the system by changing the valence around. And this has been the heart of what's been done in the post-crystal structure stuff as well, sorting out what's going on in terms of spin states in the different S states. EPR from the A0 state was discovered by Messenger when they accidentally put methanol into the sample and it appeared, but we knew that it more or less had to be a spin or half state. Alain did the S-state type stuff on that, showing that the A0 state comes around when you'd expect it to come around. EPR from S1 and S3. Again, Alain did quite a lot of the stuff. Alain Busack did on that S3 state, got the full spectrum and simulated the spin state on that. We did this picture then. Now, these question marks here are a reflection of manganese itself. It's an ambiguous system for doing spectroscopy on in many times. And so you've always got possibilities that you can't properly rule out. And to rule out those possibilities, what we really needed to have was structure, real structure. It took a while. So these are the things that came out of EPR, but then the post-structural stuff helped a lot. We'll come back to that. X-ray crystallography kicked in. We started off with things which were really very poor, but it looks like a funny-shaped thing, but maybe it's a 3+1. That made sense. There was not much information in the first crystal structures, but it was saying they're on their way. That was in 2001 from Zuni, from Witt's group. They didn't have any resolution of the amino acid side chains. These were just alanines in the system. This was no better. When Jim Barber got a sort of force, and Soyawata got like a force fit structure to a system at 3.5, then this gave us some kind of information. This was something that Alain and I did when we were looking at that first structure. They had misassigned some density in this region here, which we knew couldn't be bicarbonate, and we knew that it was more likely to be the substrates, and so we modeled in the substrates here, and so we could see that the distances were going to be interesting because it's that close from the calcium to the tyrosine. I would say the big thing about the first crystal structure which first resolved crystal structure, the one from Barber and Iwata, was that the calcium was unambiguously part of the cluster. Now, we had data for that from EPR, but it was still ambiguous. So we were juggling, but the data was pretty clear. We just couldn't say absolutely. This said absolutely it's in the cluster, and that was the big deal from this first structure, as well as the distance to the tyrosine and its base, its histidine base. So the first real structure, you know, the resolution was actually poor, and it didn't really help. There were lots of calculations done. It's a poor structure. It didn't advance what was going on. And then, so they thought that we're going to have to wait forever. But then out of the blue, after about 4 or 5 years working on this thing, a structure appeared that was 1.9 angstrom units. So things were resolved. That was a revolution. What was the revolution? The revolution was we got the geometry, we got the waters, we got the ligands to this system. So it's really it's a different geometry from the one that was first published. This is like a distorted chair. The big deal here is that this oxygen in the middle here, which is the oxygen 5, actually these bonds are slightly too long to be proper bonds. And the cluster was reduced by the X-ray beam to some extent. But even when it's not, then these bonds are pointing to this one being sometimes this side, sometimes this side, some sort of flexibility in this system. That's just you saw that picture of Mark's thing, but this is just my drawings of this. What we got was the ligands, and you can see they're all carboxylic acids. They're all but one bidentate, and all but one are carboxylic acids, and the one that isn't is a histidine in this system. So here's your list. And there are 4 terminal waters, and numbered 1, 2, 3, 4. And this number 4, which is the one that Alan and I modeled in the first instance, that's hydrogen bonded to the tyrosine. And we could see the chlorides as well, the chlorides in this system. We knew where the chlorides were. We knew there were 2 because of enzymology we'd done in my lab. We knew that those 2 were in these positions because Alan had replaced the chlorides with bromide and given them to Jim Barber, and they'd found the 2 positions for these chlorides, and so Shen verified those. There's more than just ligands. There's hydrogen bonds to this system from these here. So there's a bunch of hydrogen bonds at different places as well to the oxo groups in this cluster. And there's lots of information now in these beautiful channels that are going on in this system. There's a channel here. They've all got different names. They call them these names. They actually don't know. It's arguable that this is one of the water inways. It's arguable that this is one of the proton. This is coming to the oxygen 4, and this one was, when I was working with Ishikita, he calculated that this was deprotonation on the S0 to S1 step. I'm not sure that's true, but it was a beautiful calculation that Ishikita did on that. And this one is almost certainly a proton exit under the conditions, and I'll talk about that in a minute. So with this structure, then finally the computational chemistry that had been spinning their wheels for years on the wrong structures that didn't have enough resolution to do anything started to do things, and they kicked in big style. So you can look at. I mean, obviously, when you've got a structure straight away, Shen was saying, "Well, maybe this one's close enough to be making an oxygen-oxygen bond, and maybe this one's close enough to make an oxygen job." You could be speculating, and just there was about 5 different speculations in that first paper. Not very helpful, but the computational chemistry could really do the thing. The numbers when the crystal structure came out were clearly wrong. They didn't fit with the spectroscopy. And so people then, the first year they came out, every single calculation group calculated their own structure where they put it right, because it couldn't be what they were published. And this was beam damage. This was electrons from the beams essentially reducing those manganese. And when the manganese reduced, things open up a bit. So people corrected it in their computers. And there was, there was 10 corrected structures probably within minutes type thing. But the other way to correct it was actually to try and use less beam in the system. And they'd gone into that by doing XFEL, which is free electron laser. So they basically it I don't know if you know this, it's like the biggest and most expensive experiment in the world. They shoot crystals into a beam, they flash them if they want to turn things over, and the X-ray laser vaporizes the sample in about half a picosecond, and you've got to take all the data in the first 100 or so femtoseconds, and they do that millions of times, and they manage to get a structure out of it. Sounds like science fiction. It certainly was, and because all the first papers that were in Nature were published because of the science fiction nature of the data, and science fiction nature of the method, not the data, because they had no data. It was only later that kicked in, and now it's a beautiful, beautiful, amazing method, and we'll come to that later. But they started doing that in order to avoid the beam damage, and so that improved things, and the distances became closer to those calculations before. So which manganese are going to oxidize? We know this in the structure. This is the one, it's the manganese 2 over here, which is the start, which is always manganese 4. You go through the system from 2 to 1, from S0 to S1, and then the next one that gets oxidized is the one on this side here, which is 3. I should have my glasses on. But this is 3, it's all done by memory. Honest. And then this one is the one that goes next when you go to S2, but this one has got this spin isomer thing going on. The spin isomer causes electron transfer within the cluster, so it's going down, the manganese 4 is going between the 1 position and the 4 position, and there's not much energy difference between those. This is the high spin form, the G4 signal we were talking about before, and this is the low spin form. It's hopping between those two, and that's really probably really important because it's in manganese 3 that you can do exchange rapidly with waters. Manganese 4, it's all locked up. So by having this hopping around, things can be changing. So waters can be exchanging under these conditions. Those are the substrates. When you get to manganese 4, then of course all the manganese are reduced. And then, of course, we keep going on. We'll come back to that. So terminal waters, which are terminal waters, which are substrates? There's lots of stuff here. MIMS, I'm not going to really go into. This is MIMS, is this mass spec, kinetic mass spec. Quite interesting. It puts limits on things. You can see 2 rates of substrate coming in by doing flashes and mass spec. It's very interesting. It's been done most recently, mostly by Messenger. But recently they were saying that, and you can sort of make choices on that, but recently they were saying that the kinetics are affected by changes in the channels to some extent. So the earlier limitations coming from exchanging calcium and saying that seeing how the rates were changed could be compromised by the fact that we know that when the channels get changed, then they could be changing the binding stuff as well. So the choices made based on the MIMS are a bit questionable these days. But if you combine that with some of the EPR, then they came up with some good answers. This again, this was Alain Boussac was providing samples to Nick Cox and people who had previously worked in our lab and went to Lubitz's place where they've got these amazing instruments. And they did this fantastic kind of measurement, sort of LDO detected NMR with oxygen 17. They also have money. You can buy oxygen 17 in Germany. And you could figure out where things are. And the take-home was something which was obvious from the first crystal structure, that the important one is the oxygen that is oxygen 5 that's bouncing around, the one that's got the long bond lengths and stuff. So oxygen 5 is considered to be one of the substrates. If that's the slow one, then what's the fast one? There are a number of possibilities. So this is oxygen 5, we think that's one of the substrates. And we think that it's one of the possibilities that are discussed a lot is that whether it's the water 2 or the water 3. The water 3 was actually ruled out by MIMS, but we think this is the most likely one these days because I think that idea was wrong on the MIMS. Structural flexibility, I talked about that. This flexibility is an important thing to get exchangeability in with the substrates. And this is, I've talked about that again, it's the high spin, low spin stuff, hopping back and forward, opening and closing of the cube is one thing that's discussed a lot, and I'm not going to go into that. There is also flexibility in S3. You see these 3 different kinds of S3s. Alan Boussac was, again, the person who determined there were two different kinds of S3 going on in the system. One of them is EPR detectable. He sent the samples to Nick Cox that allowed him to sort out the structure based on that fancy kind of EPR and what's going on with S3. So there's a big focus on S3, and a lot of the experimental work has been done by Alan Boussac recently in recent years, and this is the most important stuff on that in experimentally, but there's a lot of focus on it in terms of calculations, and this is one of the calculation things, and of course, naturally, I choose the one that I was associated with, but it's actually, this is working with Ville Kaila in Stockholm. And this is going from the S2 to the S3 state. And this is done, the calculations have been done in high spin and low spin form and covering changes from low spin to high spin as well. But I just show you the simplistic one where it's going from the low spin form. Here's the open cube with the pendant manganese 4 on this side. The blue is the manganese 3. Oxygen 5 is this one here, and that's the one that's jumping around. Here's the calcium in your system, and here's your bound waters. You've got water 1, water 2, 3, and 4. 4 is hydrogen bonded to the tyrosine. The tyrosine is hydrogen bonded to its base, the histidine. And water 3 is in this hydrogen bonding network. And then what goes on if you do the calculation is if you put an electron on here and a positive charge here, which is what happens, then this influences the system so that the water 3 actually deprotonates. And it deprotonates through the hydrogen bonding system through to the other side and connects up to the outside and spits that proton right to the outside via the aspartate 61 and the one of the chlorides. And the aspartate 61 and the chlorides are involved in ion pair stuff, which actually shakes things around as you go through them and ends up pushing the proton out in that way. But anyway, that's what happens. And when that occurs, when this is deprotonated in the presence of the positive charge and the radical here, then this water 3 then swings over in the calcium and then binds onto the manganese 3, which is over in the one position on the other side of the cube. And that's what you see it there, bound there. And that's what's happening in the S3 state, we think, in this particular model. And people have hooked onto this because it seems like a great idea. It was just published in BBA in those days, and it's got lots of citations because it's seeming like it fits with lots of things. So that's what I'm talking about there. Anyway, water oxidation, we do the same thing. So the same calculations with Ville Kaila, we did the similar kind of thing. The next step, so you went to S3, it was all manganese 4s. All of the environments of each one of those manganese 4s were similar. They were all 6-coordinate and similar to each other. So this is what happened. That's what we got here, this structure. And actually what I didn't say was that when the water 3 moves across from the calcium and onto the manganese 1, then water 5, which was previously hydrogen bonded to it, moves in and takes its place on the calcium. So there's a shunt of there's just a swap over under those circumstances. So you see there is a water 3 position there now, but this is the manganese 5 that's moved, this is the water 5 that moved into this position. And on here, you've got the water. So the water that was the W3. We have a deprotonation here. We know now that's the wrong order. It's already deprotonated. That's just in the wrong place. Doesn't matter. The point is that when you get down to this bit, and this is, we've got the same, all manganese 4s, the radical, the charge close by, these are really important. It does the same thing. Basically, the hydroxo on the water 3, which is now bound to oxygen 1, deprotonates, and it deprotonates right across the hydrogen bond network and goes out the same route as the one in S3 did. And so the calculation shows that pretty clearly. And then what's going on is that when that happens, then there's electron transfer takes place, and it takes place from that deprotonated water, and it forms an oxale radical. And the oxale radical bound to manganese 4 in the one position here is close to the oxygen 5, which we know is the other substrate, right? So you can see the proximity is close enough for the oxide radical to do its stuff and form a peroxo intermediate. To form a peroxo intermediate is a 2-electron intermediate in this system. The first electron is gone, forming the radical. The second electron comes from the manganese 4 in the system and forms the peroxo intermediate. And then, having got the peroxo 2-electron intermediate, then the other two manganese in the system both go reduced and form the oxygen, which leaves the system. And when it leaves the system, then the oxygen, the water 5, which was the thing that bound onto the calcium, when the water 3 zipped across, actually then folds in and probably forms the next oxygen 5 in the cube. So we got these models, which are pretty good. And this was 2016. The X-ray crystallography guy came in with the X-FEL stuff, and they found the density that we were talking about down here next to the manganese 1, but they claim it's still bound to the calcium in the circumstances. We didn't suggest that, but I'll tell you in a minute. But this is what they see on the S2 to S3 state, so they're not saying that the water 3 came down here, but it's one of the possibilities. It's certainly in this position. This is also the position that was suggested by Per Sigbaum in one of his early models, who also is the big proponent of the radical mechanism in this system. Anyway, so predicted binding of a water to the manganese 1 is now being detected directly in this system. Okay, and the reason they've still got ligand from the calcium to that oxo group here, hydroxo possibly under these conditions, and should be in our model anyway, is because the ligand changed on the calcium in that. So you've got the glutamate 189 becomes very, very long. Essentially, it deligands from the system on that step and goes back on again. And this is what's being seen in this time-resolved X-ray stuff. So this is fitting our models to some extent. They also, based on their X-ray stuff, they came up with various different possible formations of the oxygen-oxygen bond, and one of them is the one that we suggested, of course, but other people have suggested it too. But anyway, the point is that the structures don't define the mechanism, the calculations help. So that's our model, essentially, where we think that the what we take to be the oxide radical, which was started up here, moved down in S3, and that the oxygen-oxygen bond is forming between 5 and this oxide radical there. So that's just the picture. That's the one I showed you before, which I think is good. There's another article which we're writing. I was working on it on the train with Vili Kaila, which is the next phase of this, which is where the protons are going, and these ion pair stuff for getting rid of the protons. What we want to do is, I mean, this is great. What we're saying here is, I said before, we can't measure these intermediates because of the rates. These intermediates are being calculated. They're presumably all occurring at rates where you can't detect them because they're not the rate-limiting step. And so what's going on here is that it's great, and we can put forward these models, and some of them make a lot of sense, but how can we test them? And I think this is the big question now, is to find testable features of these models. And so what we desperately need is more real experimental stuff, taking the crystal structures and the calculations into account and saying, what can be done? And those kind of things are the kind of things that Alain Boussac has been doing. And those are the kind of things that we desperately need more of, instead of everybody shutting down and doing a calculation in the privacy of their own clothes, which is what's going on. We need to be in the labs. We need to be messing with the enzyme to try and slow things down, modify it, get into the intermediates to see what's actually going on. So I believe that that is the future. That has to happen. The calculations will give us the answer, but we won't know which one because they'll give us 12 different answers. So what have we learned about water oxidation? Well, I could stop now if you like, but I just want to give you this background thing. Take homes. There's redox compensation. You lose protons from your system as you accumulate charges. Otherwise, it wouldn't work. That's one thing. You do four electron chemistry. Even the models are saying it's four electron chemistry, but two by two in a very short period. But that's how you do things. You don't get partial oxidation, partial, and they're hanging around. That's not what's happened. These are two reactive as intermediates. Everything happens in one shot. So effectively, it's four things in one shot, and that's how it works. You get a four oxidation of water and a four electron reduction of the catalyst, and that's how it works. And it's not a coincidence we've got four manganese in there, but as you saw, we're not oxidizing all the manganese. It's a sort of buffery thing. And multinuclear manganese, it only goes as far as manganese 4, it doesn't go as far as manganese 5, and you've got the radical in there, we believe. The role of the calcium in there, this is really important. It's clear, these models are saying the role of the calcium is substrate delivery. It's not redox active, obviously, it's a calcium. But what's special about calcium is that calcium are big fuzzy things in terms of metals, and they can do coordination in all different directions, and they can have many numbers of coordinations, and that's perfect for this kind of enzyme. You bring waters in here, you give them down there, without being stuck in a hard coordination sphere, which is locked up. Calcium's great for that. Take it here, give it there, do that, I'll take another one. That's what calciums do. It's doing exactly that in this system. I suggested that in 1989. It was providing the substrate to the enzyme. That's what we're seeing in the system. Now, there's another thing here. Why do you need to provide the substrate to the enzyme in this way? The enzyme is sufficiently oxidizing to partially oxidize water at those lower redox states. You don't have to go to manganese 444 to oxidize water. We said going from manganese 2 to manganese 3 is a volt. You can do those kind of things. We don't want to do that. We want to do it at high valence so that when you've oxidized them all, you're only going from 4 to 3. That's why you've got 4 manganese in your system. But you don't want to have oxidized the water too early where you form those intermediates. So if you allow the substrate to get in too early, you will get premature oxidation of the system, formation of peroxide, other problems like that. Your manganese will go back down to manganese 2 and 4 out because that's soluble. You will have huge inefficiencies in your system. It's really important to keep those levels of the reduction level of the manganese up. They all stay solid. There's not much movement going on with them. There's a little bit of movement going on within them, as we saw, but not much. You can do 4 electron chemistry without everything falling apart. It's clear that that's the case. The calcium is to keep the substrate water out of there until you're ready to put it in. And it puts it in at the right moment, the S3 state. But already in the S3 state, you don't get any reactivity until you trigger it by the deprotonation, which is due to the charge effects of the tyrosine and its base, which is so close to it, which triggers those deprotonations. That triggers the formation of the radical. Then you get your oxygen-oxygen bond in your system. The role of the chlorides, the role of the chlorides, it seems to be involved in this deprotonation, as I said. So there you go. This is thanks to my co-workers and my fellow researchers. Co-workers, I've talked about Alan Buschek a lot in this. He's worked with me on this for many years. After he did his PhD, he came to work with me in Saclay. I've been working more recently with Vili Kyler on calculations and Ishikita on calculations to do this kind of thing. These are the people that fund. Thank you very much for your attention. And I'm very sorry that I've gone over time.